We will take a look at the history of guns and gun control in the United States and the central role that this debate has played in our politics, past and present. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It is 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, September the 28th. We will talk with the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And we will welcome your questions and your views, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. As we will find out, our guest says the debate over gun rights and gun control has been going on for centuries in America, and it probably is not going to let up anytime soon. Adam Winkler is a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, and the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for getting up a little early.
No problem.
So let's start at the beginning. What were the Founding Fathers thinking?
Well, I think the Founding Fathers wrote the Second Amendment to protect the right of individuals to own guns. Now, remember, the Founding Fathers did not believe in a standing army. They thought that would be corrupt if we had the government's disposal, a standing army always in place. And so what they preferred was a citizens' militia, an armed body of ordinary citizens who, when called out to serve, could go home and grab their guns and be ready to fight in an instant, hence the Minutemen. And I think lost in the debate over whether the purpose of the Second Amendment is to protect militias or to protect an individual right to bear arms, one thing is pretty clear from the history, which is that the Second Amendment was designed to stop the federal government from taking away all the civilian guns.
Mm-hmm.
But they also had gun control, the Founding Fathers.
Well, that's right. You say that they required gun ownership but regulated it too?
That's right. The Founding Fathers had the equivalent of Obama's individual mandate. You know, this is the controversial provision in the Obama health care reform law that requires people to go out and buy health insurance if they don't have it. And it's quite controversial, but the very second Congress of the United States in 1792 passed a federal militia act that mandated individuals to go out and buy guns because they were needed for the national defense.
Oh my goodness. Well, you opened the book with a Supreme Court case from a few years ago. Tell us why you see this as a pivotal moment in the gun debate.
So a central part of Gunfight is the story of the District of Columbia against Heller case. This was a case that was decided by the Supreme Court in 2008, and it was remarkably the very first time the Supreme Court had occasion to rule unambiguously about the meaning of the Second Amendment. So despite all these years of history, the court had really avoided taking any Second Amendment cases for a long time, in part because most of the cases that reached the court, where people appealed for the Supreme Court to rule on the case, were involving desperate appeals by some criminal. And United States against crackhead or United States against gangbanger wasn't exactly a great vehicle for interpreting what the meaning of the Second Amendment was. So this case goes to the Supreme Court, and it's a landmark opinion, and it's actually a dramatic story in itself. It featured a rookie lawyer who had never taken a case to the Supreme Court. He was up against the NRA, which tried to stop him at every turn. And then when he gets to the Supreme Court, up against two of the finest advocates with sterling records of success at the Supreme Court, and he ends up pulling off a remarkable victory.
Yeah, so does that put an end to the debate over gun rights versus gun control?
Absolutely not. We'll be debating this for a long time to come, to be sure. But I do think it marks an important moment in the gun debate. I think that the gun debate really has pushed towards the extremes in part because of concerns over disarmament on both sides. Gun control advocates want to get rid of the guns, and gun rights advocates are really fearful that the government's going to come take their guns. And I think that this case, by saying there is an individual right to bear arms, government can never come take all your guns, in time, if that decision is accepted and becomes a sound and solid part of American constitutional law and our expectations as a culture, I think that it will change the gun debate by taking this disarmament question off the table.
Let me ask you, what side are you on?
You know what? I think that part of the problem with the gun debate generally and with so many of our political debates is that it's all about which side you're on rather than how do you think about the issue. So a funny anecdote is I was thinking about doing some television promotion, like being more of a talking head so that I could promote this book. And I talked to a booking agent, and he says to me, well, are you hard left or hard right? I said, well, that's not really the way I go about thinking about problems. And he said, well, obviously you haven't been watching television news very much.
And that's why I asked the question. But it's going to come up, our listeners might think the same thing. The point of your book is not to advocate for one side or the other?
In some ways, it's to advocate for both sides. I think that the best understanding of American history is that we have a constitutional tradition of protecting an individual right to bear arms. So I guess that puts me firmly in the gun rights camp. At the same time, what's often ignored is that we've always also had gun control. We've always tried to balance gun rights with public safety. So I guess that puts me on the gun control side. I really see the issue as one where we need to avoid the extremes that both sides have put us in and recapture a moderate middle where we can recognize some role for gun control and a clear right of individuals to have a gun for self-defense.
Well, let's talk a little bit about, I think you call it the secret history of guns. The Ku Klux Klan started as a gun control organization?
Yeah, most people don't realize this, but it's a great story that I discovered in my research, which is that before the Civil War, blacks in the South were never allowed to own guns. And during the Civil War, what happens is that some blacks go and join the Union Army, and then the Union Army, which can't pay its debts, allows the soldiers to take their guns home with them as a partial down payment of past wages due. Other African Americans go out and purchase firearms because the marketplace is flooded with guns that were produced for the war effort. So as the Civil War ends, for the very first time in American history, Southern blacks were armed. White, recalcitrant white racists who were determined to return African Americans or keep African Americans in a state of second-class citizenship set out to go get those guns because they knew that if blacks were armed, they could fight back. And so they did this by passing laws barring blacks from owning guns, but laws on the books don't necessarily stop people from doing things. So they went out, started forming these posses of men, large groups of men who would go out at night, terrorize black communities, and go into homes to take away those guns. The KKK was the most famous of those disarmament posses.
Yes, I had no idea. I also did not know that you say the Black Panthers are the true pioneers of modern gun rights.
Well, in Gunfight, I tell the remarkable story of one of the most amazing spectacles, I think, in the history of the gun debate in America. And it was a day in May 1967 when 30 Black Panthers, armed with loaded rifles, shotguns, and pistols, marched right into the California State Capitol building. And they weren't there to commit violence. They were there to protest a proposed gun control law. Ironically, it was conservatives at the time in California who were supporting the additional new gun control laws, including our governor at the time, Governor Ronald Reagan, who was pushing for more gun control laws, basically because they wanted to disarm the Black Panthers who had begun these police patrols where they'd go out in black neighborhoods and make sure that police weren't abusing or harassing African Americans in especially Oakland. So they walk into the Capitol with these armed, loaded guns, that law, that effort of on their part, leads to a backlash. California passes new gun control laws that are designed to disarm these urban black radicals. It turns out that law and other laws that are passed at the time, again, mostly to disarm or restrict access by urban blacks to guns, fuels the rise of the modern gun rights movement, which is white, rural, and known for being politically conservative.
Did you say it was Ronald Reagan who was a gun control advocate?
Isn't it amazing? It's true. We go back to California in 1967, and Ronald Reagan was standing out on the front steps of the Capitol building saying, there is no reason why in society today a person should be carrying a loaded weapon on the streets. The kind of thing that if you were to say it today, you'd be sure never to get an endorsement by the NRA. But that's part of the complicated and surprising history of guns that I found in researching Gunfight.
Now, speaking of the NRA, you say that for most of its history, it was not fighting for gun rights, it was fighting to control guns.
Well, I don't know that I phrase it quite like that, but I would say this. The NRA has not always been the diehard, no-compromises opponent of gun control that we know today. The NRA in the 1920s and 30s was at the forefront of the gun control movement. They weren't blind supporters of any and all gun control, but they did draft restrictive gun control laws on the public carrying of firearms and promoted them in state after state after state. And the NRA, even back then, was very successful, and that gun control, those gun control laws spread from coast to coast. I found a remarkable story that when Congress was considering the first major federal gun control law back in 1934, the president of the NRA was asked to testify about it, and he did, and he was asked during his testimony whether the new proposed law would violate the Second Amendment. Today, his reply is absolutely astounding. He said, quote, "I have not given it any study from that point of view." So the president of the NRA never thought about whether the most far-reaching federal gun control law in history was impacted by the Second Amendment. It really wasn't until the 1960s and 70s that the Second Amendment became the organization's heart and soul.
You know, we are in Wisconsin preparing for a new concealed carry law. It's been a controversial issue in Wisconsin for years. And it has just this summer been made legal for people to carry a concealed weapon starting in November with some training and with a permit. How does that debate fit into this gun control issue?
Well, it definitely fits in. The next big question that the Supreme Court is going to have to face is whether there is a right to have a gun outside of your home. The Supreme Court has now ruled twice in the last couple of years on the meaning of the Second Amendment, but both times the cases were limited to whether an individual had the right to have a firearm inside his own home for personal protection. But it's a slightly different question about whether you can go out onto the street with a gun and what kind of permitting will be allowed by states and local governments. You know, some places allow almost anyone to carry a gun concealed, and other places have a permitting process that's very restrictive. Here where I live in Los Angeles, it's basically impossible to get a permit to carry a gun unless you've been the subject of specific individualized death threats. I think those laws that provide unfettered discretion for government officials about whether someone will have a gun on the street or not are likely to find a hostile reception in the Supreme Court, in part because, as I found in my research, those laws have traditionally been used to keep guns away from disfavored groups or minorities that are not welcomed by the majority to carry guns.
We are talking with the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And we welcome your questions about the history of the gun debate and its present. We'll also talk some about its future. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Adam Winkler is also a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 22 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, September the 28th. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. Ben and his guests between 4 and 6 this afternoon talking about current issues of the day. We're taking a look at the history of gun rights and gun control in the United States and the role that this has played in our political debate as well. And we're welcoming your questions and your thoughts for Adam Winkler, who is the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Before we go to the phones, Professor Winkler, talk a little now about how did guns become such an important factor in elections, especially in the last few decades?
Well, guns have really become an important factor in elections over the last few decades, in part because of the rise of the modern gun rights movement. There's always been people out there who wanted to protect gun rights, but the movement has really crystallized around the NRA since the 1970s. And it's interesting, we talked earlier about the NRA often supporting gun control in the past, but what happened in the 1970s is the NRA underwent a major transformation. In particular, they had a coup d'etat at one of the annual meetings of the membership in 1977, where a group of hardliners overtook the NRA. and ousted the previous leadership that was thinking of retreating from political activity and focusing the NRA more on marksmanship training and hunting and outdoors experiences. And this new group of hardline activists took over the NRA and really recommitted the organization to political battles. And as we know, the NRA has become one of the most successful political organizations in America. And sometimes people will criticize the NRA for doing that, but I think the NRA is largely representing the views of millions of gun owners out there who really are fearful that the government's going to come and take their guns.
Yeah. Is the government going to take anyone's guns?
Well, there's been a history of people who thought that the government should be used to take our guns. In the 1970s, there really was a big movement to try to eliminate civilian ownership of firearms. And in fact, I talk about the District of Columbia against Heller case. The law involved there was a ban on handguns and a restriction on the use of long guns, shotguns and rifles, barring them for use in self-defense, too. And that law was motivated by the desire to eliminate civilian gun ownership. It's funny, I tell the story of when that law was being passed, D.C. Councilmember Marion Barry said, "This law is not going to take one gun out of the hands of one criminal." And he was a supporter of the law. But the part of the idea was they knew it wasn't going to be effective at reducing crime, but they wanted to spark a nationwide trend to get rid of guns. One thing I believe, there's 280 million guns in America, almost one per person. They're not going anywhere. Practically speaking, civilian disarmament is a non-starter.
I remember when President Obama, before he was elected, there were a lot of ads and campaign slogans that President Obama is going to take your guns. This was a big fear of the gun rights movement.
That's right, and it led to incredible increases in gun sales as well.
Right.
One of the surprising things I tell about the Heller case is that this was brought by a group of libertarian lawyers who didn't have any formal association with the gun rights movement, and the NRA was vehemently opposed to this lawsuit, even though those lawyers were trying to fulfill the NRA's vision of the Second Amendment. But at every turn, the NRA tried to scuttle this lawsuit, and the purported reason that the NRA said was that they were afraid of losing. They didn't want a conservative Supreme Court to reject their view of the Second Amendment. But the lawyers involved in that case, they suspected that there was another reason, that maybe the NRA was afraid of winning, that the NRA thrives on crisis-driven fundraising, constantly warning gun owners that if they better contribute now or the government's coming to take your guns. And if GURA won, what would that do to the NRA's fundraising machine?
Bringing it up to a present day, President Obama is purportedly going to unveil gun control reforms in the near future. This is in response to the shooting of Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. I see, though, an article in July that said this, and then this was updated again in September. Have any idea what's taking so long?
I think the Obama administration does not want to touch the gun control issue very much at all. I have no doubt that Obama would like to see better or more effective gun control laws in place. However, I think he understands the political costs of favoring gun control laws that in an electoral environment where he needs every single vote. In part, the story here, though, is that, you know, a lot of the gun control proposals that are being debated right now probably aren't going to do very much to restrict criminal access to guns or reduce crime rates. And in that kind of environment, it's hard to push for gun control laws if you think they're not going to have a huge effect on crime and they're going to cost you elections.
Yeah. Well, what sorts of things would be in that area? In terms of reforms that wouldn't really stop criminals from getting guns?
Well, I think, for example, we've talked about the assault weapons ban. And we had, for 10 years, we had a ban on so-called assault weapons. Assault weapons are really just a subgroup of the larger category of rifles, generally, but rifles that are designed to be lightweight and carried into battle by an individual soldier. But they're not necessarily more lethal than a normal rifle. And here's an example of a law that we banned the sale of these new assault rifles. But like I say, it was just a subcategory of a larger group of rifles that weren't touched by the law, and so we weren't really affecting the lethality of weapons on the street. And in fact, to differentiate these assault weapons from this larger category of rifles, the law relied on a variety of superficial features, like whether it had a pistol grip or whether it had a bayonet plug. Last I checked, there weren't a lot of bayoneting incidents in America. So the manufacturers simply just reproduced the exact same weapons without the bayonet plugs, without the pistol grips. And so we didn't actually reduce any of the lethality of weapons on the streets. We just had a law that banned us subcategory of some rifles, and that's not really going to reduce crime, I don't think.
We'll get to the phones for Adam Winkler, who is author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. And our first caller is Duane in Hayward. Hello, Duane.
Well, being a strict constitutionalist and a law enforcement officer over 30-some years, I see guns to the Second Amendment as Bibles, newspapers, radios, TV are to the First Amendment. I don't see any reason if we can buy a Bible across state lines without going through a background check, if you can buy a newspaper across state lines without going through a background check, there should be no restriction on guns, or any less restrictions or more restrictions than as buying a newspaper.
Yeah, you don't think a newspaper can't kill people, though, can it, Duane?
Oh, yeah. I can roll a newspaper up in a very hard club and kill somebody with it.
All right. Well, Adam Winkler, what about, are there a lot of people like Duane who don't think there should even be background checks for buying guns?
Well, I think that he points out a very, very important point, which is that we must think of the Second Amendment as a constitutional right, and thus there are certain limits on what government can do. I disagree with him on background checks. I think every constitutional right has to be interpreted according to its own history and its own provisions, and most people believe that the right to bear arms can be denied to people who are convicted felons or people who are mentally ill or people who are drug users, and the only way that federal law can do that is by having a background check that is conducted instantaneously, that when someone, a criminal or a drug user or a mentally ill person, goes to try to buy a gun, the gun dealer says, no, you can't buy it here because this is you failed a background check. So I think, frankly, I think we should have more background checks, not fewer background checks, in part because the basic idea of the Second Amendment was to protect the right of law-abiding people to have guns, not the right of anyone to have a gun in any circumstance.
Yeah, there is a current debate, is there not, about the gun show loophole that you could go to a gun show at a expo center and buy a gun from someone without getting a background check?
That's right. I don't like the term gun show loophole because I think it's misleading. It's not. There's no loophole for gun shows in federal law. Federal law simply requires that gun sales, whether they're at gun shows or anywhere else, be conducted according to the federal regulations. And those regulations require federally licensed gun dealers to conduct a background check every time they sell a firearm, whether at a gun show or outside a gun show. The problem is that if you're not a federally licensed dealer and you're not someone who's regularly engaged in the business of selling firearms, you just do it as a hobby or do it occasionally, then you don't have to do a background check. Gun shows are attractive for those kinds of sellers because it's like a convention where they're more likely to find someone to buy their guns. So those kinds of non-regular sellers will use gun shows, and they don't have to conduct background checks. But the loophole is really not about gun shows. The loophole is about these private sellers who can sell firearms and often do sell firearms to a lot of people, even though they're not federally licensed and they don't have to conduct a background check. So the gun show loophole is the wrong terminology for it, but the loophole does exist in federal law that allows about 40% of lawful gun sales to be conducted without a background check.
Thanks to Duane for the call. Randy in Oshkosh is with us now. Hello, Randy.
Good morning, guys. Hey, just two questions. With Adam, are you familiar with Joyce Malcolm or Don Cates?
I am.
Okay, great.
Well, who are they? We're not all of us are, Randy.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Those are liberal scholars have written. There's quite a number of books and articles by two of them are just a couple of examples of academics that have written articles opposing gun control. And not because from the point, well, this is my constitutional right, but rather because they work with individuals such as the poor, disenfranchised in society, that when gun control laws are passed, they are the ones that are impacted, and merely because they just live in a high crime neighborhood. As a matter of fact, I think that last Adam talked about, I think the last U.S. Supreme Court ruling was based off a gentleman from Chicago who lived in such kind of a neighborhood and wanted to you know, be able to defend his own home, but Chicago just made it very difficult for him.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the second question, if he's familiar with a couple of studies from Britain, one from Cambridge University, I think back in 71, it's called Firearms Control by Colin Greenwood, that had, they wanted to find out what was their, the connection between England's gun crime, or rather their violent crime, impacted by maybe how the gun laws would affect the crime rates, and they found no correlation at all, nothing direct. What they did find that it was social and cultural mores that impacted the crime levels. And again, back in 2002, if Adam has heard this one, this was from the King's College of London. Their defense studies released their findings. It was called "Illegal Firearms in the UK," and they concluded the same. And,
yeah, because we have lots of callers and lots of studies there. Maybe Adam Winkley can talk a little bit about whether.
Sure.
You know, whether the studies show that there's a correlation between gun laws and crime.
Yeah, you know, it's one of the interesting things we often think in the United States that, there's a lot of guns, and that will that's the reason why we have high crime rates. But I do think it's much more cultural than that. There's other societies out there, Western societies, in fact, that have high rates of gun ownership and very low rates of violence. So Switzerland, for instance. In Switzerland, they don't have a standing army, so they have the old citizen militia that our founding fathers envisioned. And so the government issues to every male when they come of age an assault weapon and a box of bullets, and gun violence is absolutely absent from Switzerland. Israel, another country, very high rates of gun ownership, but very low rates of criminal violence. Obviously, in our society, in America, we have lots of guns and we have lots of crime. Most of the studies that have been done here, some have shown a very slight effect, that liberalizing gun laws sometimes has the effect of diminishing criminal activity. But other studies have shown that maybe that's not the case, or that there's not a big impact in either direction by liberalizing gun laws or not. It really is a cultural phenomenon. We have a violent culture in America, and the problem is not primarily the guns, but primarily the culture.
And anything more on these liberal scholars who oppose gun control because people in poor neighborhoods should have guns to protect themselves?
Well, that's right. I even tell the story of Don Cates. I interviewed him a couple times for the book, and I tell the story of how he got involved in the gun rights movement. And it really began when he was a student at Yale Law School, and he's a liberal supporter of JFK, and he went down in the 1960s to go fight for civil rights down in North Carolina. And he was asked to protect one night, because he had a couple guns on him, he was asked to protect a civil rights activist who was a school teacher who had been threatened by the KKK. And so they stood armed guard at night waiting for the KKK to come. You know, the truth is one of the sad facts of gun laws in America is that, like so much of our history, in our history, they've been tainted by race and racism and oppression. And gun laws historically were used to keep the oppressed classes oppressed so that they wouldn't be able to fight back.
We have an open line for you if you have a question or a view on the debate over gun rights versus gun control. Our guest is the author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, talking about the past, the present, and the future of this debate. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our next caller is John in Sheboygan. Hello, John.
Well, hello. And actually, you just spoke about the topic I wanted to talk about, which is gun ownership and Switzerland. But, you know, in the United States, I was just talking to my daughter about this because she has to take a civics or history quiz. about the Bill of Rights. And, you know, the anti-federalists wanted to put more power in the hands of the states and in the individual citizen. And, you know, this has less to do with, you know, standing militias or army or whatever, as it does with, you know, individual rights, you know, laid out in the Bill of Rights.
I think that's right. I think that when we think about questions of gun ownership and gun rights and gun control, we must remember that there is this long constitutional tradition and that there are basic things that we require in the Constitution for all our constitutional rights that we're going to have to respect. And among them, things like not giving government unfettered discretion over who can exercise a right or who cannot. But look, we allow permitting. If you want to go stage a rally in Madison, you need to go get a permit. And sometimes when your public exercise of your constitutional rights has a broad public effect, then sometimes you have to have permitting systems in place and whatnot. So I think we absolutely have to treat it like a normal constitutional right. And only in doing that will we finally respect the Second Amendment in the way we should respect, I think, all our constitutional rights.
Yeah. I didn't mean to steal your thunder, John. I didn't know you wanted to bring up that situation in Switzerland. And remind us, Adam Winkler, you are issued an automatic assault weapon in Switzerland?
It's not an automatic, but you know, one of the big problems with regulation of things like assault weapons is that often we don't know exactly what we're talking about. Sometimes a lot of people think that an assault weapon is a machine gun,
mm-hmm.
something that you pull the trigger once and it just sprays gunfire all over the place. That's not what an assault weapon is. That's a machine gun, and it's a fully automatic gun, and those have been heavily regulated in federal law since the 1930s, and even today it's illegal to sell a brand new machine gun to a civilian. So those are very heavily regulated. An assault weapon, as we're really talking about, is like a normal rifle with some slightly different characteristics, but the basic idea of how it fires is the same as most other rifles, which is you want to shoot twice, you got to pull the trigger twice. It doesn't fire a lot faster than any other rifle. So part of the thing that I encourage my friends on the left who favor gun control, that when we want to adopt gun control laws, it's really important to know a lot about guns so that you can pass laws that are likely to be more effective than the old assault weapons ban.
Mm-hmm. Got it. Again, Adam Winkler is the author of Gunfight, the battle over the right to bear arms in America. He is also a professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or a story. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you after 9 o'clock. Kathleen and her guest will discuss proposed Obama administration changes to the federal No Child Left Behind Act. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. We are talking with law professor Adam Winkler, who is author of the new book, Gunfight. And we welcome your questions and views for him on the debate over gun rights. And I wanted to, before we go back to the phones, Professor Winkler, one of the things you write about is the Wild West, and that you you found that we may have the wrong idea about guns and the Wild West. What did you find out about that in your research?
Well, when we think of the Wild West, we have this image of a gunslinger walking around a Wild West town, six shooters on each hip, a rifle in each hand, a duel on Main Street every day at high noon. But one of the remarkable things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that our popular understanding of the Wild West couldn't be more inaccurate. The frontier towns, places like Dodge City, Deadwood, Tombstone, they had the most restrictive gun laws in the nation. Everyone had guns out in the untamed wilderness, but when you came into town where the civilized folk lived, you had to check your guns like you check your coat at a restaurant in the winter. When residents of Dodge City formed their municipal government in the 1870s, you know what the very first law they passed was? A gun control law. And remarkably, there was very little violence in these towns, which we think of duels at high noon every day, but these towns averaged less than 2 murders a year. Turns out there wasn't much reason to get out of Dodge.
So what do all these historical lessons from the Wild West to the KKK and everything else we've talked about, what does this tell us about how to handle the gun debate today?
Well, I think the most important thing is it tells us that we can have both a right to bear arms and gun control, that the two are not mutually exclusive. I think we've been in an environment where both sides of the gun debate have taken very extreme positions. The NRA emphasizes the second part of the Second Amendment, the part that says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, and fights against almost any gun control law because it will take us down a slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. Support this law and we're done. And the gun control side, similarly, rejects one of, I think, our oldest, most well-established constitutional traditions because they're so eager to get rid of all the guns. What I think we can learn from these the lessons of history is we can map out a way forward where we can recognize both a basic right to bear arms and gun control, that having gun control is not going to lead to all the guns being taken away, but at the same time we should recognize, advocates of gun control should recognize that there is a basic right to bear arms and we shouldn't be going so far as to try to take away those guns.
Ron in La Crosse is with us now. Hello, Ron.
Yes, I heard that the lion's share of the funds that come into the NRA's coffers actually comes from arms and munitions manufacturers. Have you looked into that?
I'm not sure that that's accurate. I've never looked into the NRA's, the detailed budget of the NRA, but the NRA gets most of its money, I understand, from individual contributions from big supporters. And even if it turns out that empirically maybe they get more money from some other sources or whatnot, there should be no denying that the NRA is a political powerhouse today, not because of their money, but because they represent the interest of millions of people who feel very strongly and very intensely about this issue, and they will make this the issue that they determine their vote on. That is why the NRA is powerful. It's not because they have a lot of money. It's because they have an incredible amount of political support in a system where in a democracy, where political support is translated into political power.
Thank you, Ron. Jeff in Flambeau is next. Hello, Jeff.
Hello. I was just wondering if your guest, while researching guns, had done any research on guns and children in this country, the history of it. I grew up in the Midwest and in a rural community in the 50s and 60s, and it was kind of a rite of passage. When you turned 12, if you were a good kid, you got a gun, and usually a 22 or a 20-gauge, and we hunted, you know, the squirrels and rabbits and pheasants for food. We also, you know, shot the skunk in the corn or in the chicken coop and the rats in the corn crib. And my cousins in Texas, they also had these guns. And everybody in my class and school, you know, waited for that moment when their father or mother would give them that gun when they turned 12. And here in Wisconsin, you know, it was 12 when you started deer hunting. So these, when you look at from Texas to North Dakota and from Oregon to Maryland, there were literally millions of children, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old children in school, armed to the hilt. I could go down to the grocery store, lay down 50 cents, and buy a box of 22 shells. So, and they weren't locked up. I had free roam of these guns. But yet, it was just unheard of to ever take a gun to school. I never heard anyone ever shot anybody in anger. And I'm just wondering what happened, because it's such a big deal now, a national thing, when a child takes his gun to school and shoots people. But yet all these kids back then treated them very respectably and could have done anything like that. Have you done any history on children with guns?
Yeah, you know, there's some interesting stories that arise out of children with guns. And you're absolutely right that for a lot of people, the attachment to firearms is cultural, that they were raised with firearms. It was part of how they built relationships with their parents and part of their recreational activities as children. I tell actually an amazing story that about Justice Antonin Scalia, who's the Supreme Court justice who wrote the Heller opinion, affirming that the Second Amendment protects an individual right to bear arms. And when he was a boy living in New York City, he grew up in New York City, he was at his local high school, he was on the shooting team, and he would carry a rifle every day on the subway with him to go to school, and no one even stopped him or thought it odd at all. Of course, today, if you were to show up on the New York City subway with a rifle, you'd be arrested very, very quickly. So times have changed, and I think in part the reason why is there's been a real spike
spike in urban crime since the 1960s. It's starting to go down, and over the last 15 years it has been going down. That's the good news. That's the good trend. But the rise in urban crime really did spark a push for more and greater gun controls and more hostility to people carrying guns in public.
How did we get from the efforts to control guns in urban areas in the 1960s to the backlash against gun control?
Well, I think part of that story, you know, goes back to the Black Panthers that we were talking about. There were a wave of gun control laws that swept the nation in the late 1960s, in part to restrict the black radicals like the Black Panthers from getting guns, or urban youth crime was fed by things like Saturday night specials. So there was an effort to try to ban the importation of such cheap weapons. And so there was these laws that really spread, and I think that there were a lot of people out there who felt that it was an example of sort of the great society thinking, where government would be able to solve all our problems. And with the rise of the new right, if you will, the conservative movement in the 1970s that ultimately propelled Ronald Reagan to office and has ever since then been a really strong force in American politics, a lot of those people thought they opposed those great society programs. They thought that we should really rely more on individuals and far less on the government.
Our next caller is John in Somerset. Hello, John.
Oh, yes. I was wondering about, you know, like the administration, they tried to circumvent the law with Fast and Furious, and there's two agents that are dead now. I think they're INS embassy employees.
I don't think I follow you, John.
Well, I think they couldn't get the legislation process that they wanted. What they wanted was to take the guns away from the people. And I think they tried to do an end round.
And who is they?
So I can provide a little context, yeah, if you'd like. So this is a scandal that's going on right now with the administration. You know, the Obama administration has been relatively scandal-free, but there's this one scandal that's brewing right now. It's called the Fast and Furious scandal, and it involved what seems to be a botched gun sting, where guns were sold to Mexican drug cartels, and then the guns were allowed to go with, or they say in the business, allowed to walk without continuing supervision and surveillance. Some of these guns are now turning up on crime scenes, including one where a U.S. border agent was shot by a gun that was sold under the auspices, really, of the ATF, and now are coming back and being used in crime. You know, I think it remains to be seen what this scandal is really all about. The caller was suggesting that the Obama administration was purposefully selling these guns to inflate numbers along the border so that they could push for more gun control laws. I don't think you need to sell guns along the border to have enough of a problem with guns along the border to mandate some kind of regulatory response. And it's the kind of conspiracy theory, you know, that the American government's out there promoting gun sales so that they could kill Americans and lead to more gun control, that I don't really buy. And I don't buy, you know, the 9/11 conspiracies that was by the government either. I generally think the government's often not that good at these kinds of things, so the conspiracies don't work so well. But, you know, the truth is that the Obama administration has, I think, mishandled the scandal. They have stonewalled investigators and really haven't made clear exactly what happened here. Was this just a bad plan that was put into a place? Was the intention to watch these guns and then someone blew it? Or was what was exactly the intention behind this program? I think, and until those answers come out, this is going to be a growing scandal that's going to get even more important for Obama as we get into the election season.
Got it. Pat in Rudolph. Hello, Pat.
Hi. Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
I've heard all the programs about Wisconsin's concealed carry law, and I'm kind of concerned about people walking around with a concealed gun that they're never, never going to have the chance to use just because the circumstances won't arise. But I do wonder, they can carry a concealed gun, but under what circumstances, first, are they allowed to have it loaded at all times? And next, under what circumstances can they take the thing out and brandish it or use it?
Yeah, I'm not sure we're really here. Our guest isn't necessarily an expert on the rules of the Wisconsin concealed carry. But
Well, usually the concealed carry rules do allow the gun to be loaded. In fact, I'm not aware of any concealed carry rules that require the gun to be unloaded. So that is usually the case. You're right. I don't know all the details of what's happening in Wisconsin policy circles, but I will say there is an amazing case that came out of Wisconsin that I think helped create some more pressure for concealed carry laws. When Wisconsin banned concealed carry and didn't allow it, there was a store owner in Milwaukee, like a liquor store owner, and he was not allowed to have a gun, and he was arrested from the police when they found him having a gun, even though in his store there had been multiple armed robberies. He had had someone hold a gun up to his head and actually pull the trigger. The gun misfired, fortunately, and he survived. There had been an actual shootout and murder in his store. So he was in a very bad area of Milwaukee and had crime in his store, but according to the law, he was not even allowed to have a firearm for his self-defense in a store where there was obviously a history of violence. And the Supreme Court of Wisconsin said, well, even though there's no right to carry a concealed firearm in your place of business, we're not going to allow you to prosecute this guy because it just seems so patently unreasonable to take someone who's clearly under threats and not give them the means to defend themselves.
Yeah, I do. I do remember that case. And I know that I don't know if it was that case, but that also led to the realization that people could openly carry a gun in Wisconsin. If it wasn't concealed, it was okay.
That's right. There's a big movement these days. A movement these days among some gun owners to openly carry firearms. And so we've had in California people showing up at Starbucks stores
right.
with guns on their hip and whatnot. And it's created quite an uproar. I think, you know, the truth is the vast majority of gun owners do not wish to openly carry their firearms. They believe that that's going to just cause problems with the police and cause problems with their friends and neighbors. And what they'd rather do is more discreetly carry a firearm hidden underneath their clothes.
Yeah. As far as you know, Wisconsin now, I think, is the 49th state to allow concealed weapons. Illinois might be the only one to go. Has this changed the face of crime in society all over the country or not?
Well, there have been some studies on this. There's a very famous book by a guy named John Lott called More Guns, Less Crime, and his was an empirical social science work that said that looked at the numbers and ran regressions and whatnot and found that in states where they allowed more people to carry concealed weapons, violent crime rates dropped. But the story was always kind of complex. On the other hand, nonviolent crimes spiked during that time. There was also some other studies that came out and poked at his study and found that, well, you know, if you add a certain number of years, additional years to the study, or take one state out, it totally changes the effect. And it turns out that there's no effect on crime rates by liberalizing these gun laws. The thing I point out in my book is that one thing all of these studies sort of agree on is that the impact on crime from liberalizing concealed carry rights is very small. It might be small in one direction, it might be small in the other direction, but it doesn't lead to people getting into shootouts on the street. It doesn't turn our streets into what we imagine the old Wild West to be, although as I point out in my book, that wasn't what the Wild West was like at all.
That's right. Well, in our last couple of minutes, what is the next frontier in the gun rights debate? Is there an issue coming up that we should be keeping an eye on?
Well, it's definitely this question of whether there's a right to have a firearm outside of the home and what kind of permitting states can put in place. That's the biggest issue in the courts. You know, one of the stories that I mentioned in the book is that, you know, we think in today's society that the gun control advocates are losing all these debates, that the gun rights side is so politically strong that they keep winning. And it's true, in the legislatures, the gun rights side are winning almost all the battles. But in court, the gun control advocates are the ones who are winning. There have been over 250 federal court decisions on the constitutionality of a wide variety of gun control laws since that Heller case that I talk about in my book, Gunfight, since that case was decided. And almost every single case upholds the challenge gun control laws. There's literally been only one or two gun laws that have been struck down by the federal courts in the last few years. So there's an area where the gun rights advocates are winning, and that's mostly in legislatures, but the gun control advocates are really winning in court.
Well, thank you so much for this lesson. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler, professor of constitutional law at the University of California, Los Angeles, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There is much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.